Chapter 18. Bernal came on two successive Sundays, and the second time he lingered till the Tuesday. "Here he comes," Wade said, the first evening, as the two young men, with Wade's mother, sat in the sultry dusk, with the Virginian creeper drawing, between the veranda arches, its black arabesques against a moon-lined sky. In the darkness, Bernald heard a step on the gravel, and saw the red flit of a cigar through the shrubs. Then a loosely moving figure obscured the patch of sky between the creepers, and the red spark became the center of a dim bearded face, in which Bernald discerned only a broad white gleam of forehead. It was the young man's subsequent impression that Winterman had not spoken much that first evening. At any rate, Bernald himself remembered chiefly what the Waits had said. And this was the more curious, because he had come for the purpose of studying their visitor, and because there was nothing to divert him from that purpose in Waits' halting communications or his mother's artless comments. He reflected afterward that there must have been a mysteriously fertilizing quality in the stranger's silence. It had brooded over their talk like a large moist cloud above a dry country. Mrs. Wade, apparently apprehensive lest her son should have given Bernald an exaggerated notion of their visitor's importance, had hastened to qualify it before the latter appeared. "He's not what Ewer Howland would call intellectual," Bernald writhed at the coupling of the names, "odd in the least literary, though he told Bob he used to write. I don't think, though, it could have been what Howland would call writing." Mrs. Wade always mentioned her younger son with a reverential drop of the voice. She viewed literature much as she did Providence, as an inscrutable mystery, and she spoke of Howland as a dedicated being, set apart to perform secret rites within the veil of the sanctuary. "I shouldn't say he had a quick mind," she continued, reverting apologetically to Winterman. "S sometimes he hardly seems to follow what we're saying. But he's got such sound ideas, when he does speak he's never silly. And clever people sometimes are, don't you think so?" Bernald groaned an unqualified assent. "And he's so capable. The other day something went wrong with the kitchen range, just as I was expecting some friends of Bob's for dinner. And do you know, when Mr. Winterman heard we were in trouble, he came and took a look, and knew at once what to do? I told him it was a dreadful pity he wasn't married." Close on midnight, when the session on the veranda ended, and the two young men were strolling down to the bungalow at Winterman's side, Bernald's mind reverted to the image of the fertilizing cloud. There was something brooding, pregnant, in the silent presence beside him. He had, in place of any circumscribing impression of the individual, a large hovering sense of manifold latent meanings. And he felt a distinct thrill of relief when, halfway down the lawn, Dr. Bob was checked by a voice that called him back to the telephone. "Now I'll be with him alone," thought Bernald, with a throb like a lover's. In the low-ceilinged bungalow, Winterman had to grope for the lamp on his desk, and as its light struck up into his face, Bernald's sense of the rareness of his opportunity increased. He couldn't have said why, for the face, with its ridged brows, its shabby grayish beard and blunt Socratic nose, made no direct appeal to the eye. It seemed rather like a stage on which remarkable things might be enacted, like some shaggy moorland landscape dependent for form and expression on the clouds rolling over it, and the bursts of light between, and one of these flashed out in the smile with which Winterman, as if in answer to his companion's thought, said simply, as he turned to fill his pipe, "colon, now we'll talk." So he'd known all along that they hadn't yet, and had guessed that, with Bernald, one might. The young man's glow of pleasure was so intense that it left him for a moment unable to meet the challenge, and in that moment he felt the brush of something winged and summoning. His spirit rose to it with a rush, but just as he felt himself poised between the ascending pinions, the door opened and Bob Wade plunged in. "Too bad. I'm so sorry. It was from Howland, to say he can't come tomorrow after all." The doctor panted out his news with honest grief. I tried my best to pull it off for you, and my brother wants to come. He's keen to talk to you and see what he can do. But you see, he's so tremendously in demand. He'll try for another Sunday later on. Winterman nodded with a whimsical gesture. Oh, he'll find me here. I shall work my time out slowly. He pointed to the scattered sheets on the kitchen table which formed his writing desk. Not slowly enough to suit us, Wade answered hospitably. Oh, only, if Howland could have come, he might have given you a tip, or two, put you on the right track, shown you how to get in touch with the public. Winterman, his hands in his sagging pockets, lounged against the bare pine walls, twisting his pipe under his beard. Does your brother enjoy the privilege of that contact? He questioned gravely. Wade stared a little. Oh, of course Howland's not what you'd call a popular writer. He despises that kind of thing. But whatever he says goes with the chaps that count, and everyone tells me he's written the book on Pellerin. You must read it when you get back your eyes. He paused, as if to let the name sink in, but Winterman drew at his pipe with a blank face. Why, you must have heard of Pellerin, I suppose, the doctor continued. I've never read a word of him myself. He's too big a proposition for me. But one can't escape the talk about him. I have him crammed down my throat even in hospital. The interns read him at the clinics. He tumbles out of the nurses' pockets. The patients keep him under their pillows. Oh, with most of them, of course, it's just a craze, like the last new game or puzzle. They don't understand him in the least. Howland says that even now, 25 years after his death, and with his books in everybody's hands, there are not 20 people who really understand Pellerin. And Howland ought to know, if anybody does. He's what's their great word? Interpreted him. You must get Howland to put you through a course of Pellerin. And as the young men, having taken leave of Winterman, retraced their way across the lawn, Wade continued to develop the theme of his brother's accomplishments. I wish I could get Howland to take an interest in Winterman. This is the third Sunday he's chucked us. Of course he does get bored with people consulting him about their writings, but I believe, if he could only talk to Winterman, he'd see something in him, as we do. And it would be such a godsend to the poor man to have someone to advise him about his work. I'm going to make a desperate effort to get Howland here next Sunday. It was then that Bernald vowed to himself that he would return the next Sunday at all costs. He hardly knew whether he was prompted by the impulse to shield Winterman from Howland Wade's ineptitude, or by the desire to see the latter abandon himself to the full shamelessness of its display. But of one fact he was blissfully assured, and that was of the existence in Winterman of some quality which would provoke Howland to the amplest exercise of his fatuity. How he'll draw him. Bernald chuckled, with a security the more unaccountable, that his one glimpse of Winterman had shown the latter only as a passive subject for experimentation, and he felt himself avenged in advance for the injury of Howland Wade's existence. 3. That this hope was to be frustrated, Bernald learned from Howland Wade's own lips, the day before the two young men were to meet at Porchester. I can't really, my dear fellow, the interpreter lisped, passing a polished hand over the faded smoothness of his face. Oh, an authentic engagement, I assure you. Otherwise, to oblige old Bob, I'd submit cheerfully to looking over his foundling's literature. But I'm pledged this week to the Pellerin Society of Kenosha. I had a hand in founding it, and for 2 years now they've been patiently waiting for a word from me, the Fiat Lux, so to speak. You see, it's a ministry, Bernald, I assure you. I look upon my calling quite religiously. As Bernald listened, his disappointment gradually changed to relief. Howland, on trial, always turned out to be too insufferable, and the pleasure of watching his antics was invariably lost in the impulse to put a sanguinary end to them. If he'd only keep his beastly pink hands off Pellerin, Bernald groaned, thinking of the thick manuscript condemned to perpetual incarceration in his own desk by the publication of Howland's definitive work on the great man. One couldn't, after Howland Wade, expose oneself to the derision of writing about Pellerin. The eagerness with which Wade's book had been devoured proved, not that the public had enough appetite for another, but simply that, for a stomach so undiscriminating, anything better than Wade had given it would be too good. And Bernald, in the confidence that his own work was open to this objection, had stoically locked it up. Yet if he had resigned his exasperated intelligence to the fact that Wade's book existed, and was already passing into the immortality of perpetual republication, he could not, after repeated trials, adjust himself to the author's talk about Pellerin. When Wade wrote of the great dead he was egregious, but in conversation he was familiar and fond. It might have been supposed that one of the beauties of Pellerin's hidden life and mysterious taking off would have been to guard him from the fingering of anecdote. But biographers like Howland Wade were born to rise above such obstacles. He might be vague or inaccurate in dealing with the few recorded events of his subject's life, but when he left fact for conjecture, no one had a firmer footing. Whole chapters in his volume were constructed in the conditional mood and packed with hypothetical detail, and in talk, by the very law of the process, hypothesis became affirmation, and he was ready to tell you confidentially the exact circumstances of Pellerin's death, and of the distressing incident leading up to it. Bernald himself not only questioned the form under which this incident was shaping itself before posterity, but the mere radical fact of its occurrence. He had never been able to discover any break in the dense cloud enveloping Pellerin's later life and its mysterious termination. He had gone away, that was all that any of them knew. He who had so little, at any time, been with them or of them, and his going had so slightly stirred the public consciousness, that even the subsequent news of his death, laconically imparted from afar, had dropped unheeded into the universal scrap basket, to be long afterward fished out, with all its details missing, when some inquiring spirit first became aware, by chance encounter with a two-penny volume in a London bookstall, not only that such a man as John Pellerin had died, but that he had ever lived, or written. It need hardly be noted that Howland Wade had not been the pioneer in question. His had been the wiser part of swelling the chorus when it rose, and gradually drowning the other voices by his own insistent note. He had pitched the note so screamingly, and held it so long, that he was now the accepted authority on Pellerin, not only in the land which had given birth to his genius, but in the Europe which had first acclaimed it. And it was the central point of pain in Bernald's sense of the situation, that a man who had so yearned for silence as Pellerin should have his grave piped over by such a voice as Wade's. Bernald's talk with the interpreter had revived this ache to the momentary exclusion of other sensations, and he was still sore with it when, the next afternoon, he arrived at Porchester for his second Sunday with the Wades. At the station he had the surprise of seeing Winterman's face on the platform, and of hearing from him that Dr. Bob had been called away to assist at an operation in a distant town. Mrs. Wade wanted to put you off, but I believe the message came too late, so she sent me down to break the news to you, said Winterman, holding out his hand. Perhaps because they were the first conventional words that Bernald had heard him speak, the young man was struck by the relief his intonation gave them. She wanted to send a carriage, Winterman added, but I told her we'd walk back through the woods. He looked at Bernald with a sudden kindness that flushed the young man with pleasure. Are you strong enough? It's not too far? Oh, no. I'm pulling myself together. Getting back to work is the slowest part of the business. Not on account of my eyes, I can use them now, though not for reading, but some of the links between things are missing. It's a kind of broken spectrum. Here, that boy will look after your bag. The walk through the woods remained in Bernald's memory as an enchanted hour. He used the word literally, as descriptive of the way in which Winterman's contact changed the face of things, or perhaps restored them to their primitive meanings. And the scene they traversed one of those little untended woods that still, in America, fringe the tawdry skirts of civilization acquired, as a background to Winterman, the hush of a spot aware of transcendent visitings. Did he talk, or did he make Bernal talk? The young man never knew. He recalled only a sense of lightness and liberation, as if the hard walls of individuality had melted, and he were merged in the poet's deeper interfusion, yet without losing the least sharp edge of self. This general impression resolved itself afterward into the sense of Winterman's wide elemental range. His thought encircled things like the horizon at sea. He didn't, as it happened, touch on lofty themes. Bernald was gleefully aware that, to Howell and Wade, their talk would hardly have been talk at all, but Winterman's mind, applied to lowly topics, was like a powerful lens that brought out microscopic delicacies and differences. The lack of Sunday trains kept Dr. Bob for 2 days on the scene of his surgical duties, and during those 2 days Bernald seized every moment of communion with his friend's guest. Winterman, as Wade had said, was reticent as to his personal affairs, or rather as to the practical and material conditions to which the term is generally applied. But it was evident that, in Winterman's case, the usual classification must be reversed, and that the discussion of ideas carried one much farther into his intimacy than any specific acquaintance with the incidents of his life. That's exactly what Howell and Wade and his tribe have never understood about Pellerin. That it's much less important to know how, or even why, he disappeared. Bernald pulled himself up with a jerk, and turned to look full at his companion. It was late on the Monday evening, and the two men, after an hour's chat on the veranda to the tune of Mrs. Wade's knitting needles, had bidden their hostess goodnight, and strolled back to the bungalow together. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.